Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. This week, we're connecting the dots between a Supreme Court case, Susan Sarandon, and the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. I know. How are all these things connected? Well, we're going to find out with NPR's senior arts reporter Elizabeth Blair and Sandhya Dirks, who covers race and identity for NPR. Elizabeth, Sandhya, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Hey, Brittany, thank you.
Hi, Brittany.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you both here. Okay, so I know you both have a lot to say about what we're going to talk about, but let me just set the stage. So this week we saw two different scenes that show how America's relationship to protesting has been evolving. In San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Seattle, pro-Palestinian protesters blocked traffic on highways and bridges. On the same day, in Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court made it incredibly difficult to protest in a lot of the American South. Elizabeth, Sandhya, any other protest news I missed this week?
Oh, boy. So what I've been watching protest-wise this week is massive protests at Columbia University, where they've set up a tent city.
I was just reading that Google, employees at Google staged a sit-in and that some of them have been fired. Is that right?
Yep. That happened
too.
Wow. There's protest news everywhere right now. We are in a moment of protest and in a moment of crisis around that protest.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. But to kick things off more broadly, a protest itself, at the most basic level, is a way to express disagreement with something going on. But I wonder, what do you both think a protest means to people in America? What are protests for? Sandhya, I'd love to hear from you on this first.
So on the most existential level, and I've thought about this a lot because I've covered protests basically my entire career, I think protests on a really existential level are a way to express communal grief. They are a way for people to come together when something terrible has happened or when they feel a grave injustice has occurred. And we don't have a lot of spaces for communal grief in our culture, right? We often tend to experience grief as something very personal.
That's really interesting. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Well, I think Americans think it's critical to democracy to be able to take to the streets if you disagree with something. And as Sandhya said, show solidarity, find solidarity. But over time, I think we've seen a lot of people call protesters disruptive and disrespectful. Protests have turned violent. That's not actually new.
That's a really good point. I don't know, at least for the people in my life, protest has been a way to assert a vision of the future that you all collectively want. But I also feel like I've seen a lot of what you've discussed, Elizabeth. I've seen a lot of responses from people, especially recently, where you see a lot of people who aren't participating in protest complaining about how protests themselves are some sort of inconvenience. I feel like I've heard that a lot recently.
You know, so they're also a place to try to utilize political power, often from groups that have not had historically political power, right? And let's also remember that America was founded on protest.
Boston Tea Party, that's a notable protest.
Yeah, a little bit of a one. But, you know, I do think that there is also this narrative. And this narrative is also nothing new about the inconvenience of the protests. I remember covering a protest, Black Lives Matter protest, where the Bay Bridge was also shut down. Mm-hmm. And the protesters had dressed up in their Sunday best, right? And they said that they were trying to emulate the protest on the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Right, in Selma in the 1960s, yeah.
Bloody Sunday, right? And and they said that they were doing that, and I put that quote on the air, and I got angry emails from listeners who said, how dare you compare them to what happened in the Civil Rights Movement? They didn't inconvenience anyone in the Civil Rights Movement, which is false historically, but also there's this sense that now people are inconveniencing people. For example, the protesters on the Bay Bridge, these protesters, Now, the San Francisco DA, she's trying to charge protesters who stop traffic with false imprisonment, basically saying that they falsely imprisoned the commuters who were on the bridge.
That is an interesting application of the law, very interesting application of the law. You know, it's interesting that the protests this week in San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Chicago, where pro-Palestinian protesters were blocking highways and bridges, that those are happening during a time when there seems to be a sort of backlash against protesting. And one of the things that stands out to me as what sets America apart from a lot of other countries in the world, even other developed nations, is our First Amendment. Of course, protecting freedom of the press, free speech, but also it protects our right to peacefully assemble, to protest, to speak our minds and dissent against something that's happening in the world. And this week, the Supreme Court decided not to take up a case, McKesson versus Doe. And in doing so, they're effectively allowing Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas to make it really burdensome to protest because people organizing protests could face charges if anyone attending their event breaks the law. Meaning, like, say, if you've organized a protest against police violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, and a white supremacist attacks one of your protesters, you, the organizer, would be liable for the white supremacist's actions, which is really, it just feels very wild to me, this prospect right now. Sandhya, I know you've been watching how there's been some anti-protest sentiment brewing or fomenting right now.
Not just sentiment, it's actual legislation, right? And it's happening on an increasing level, particularly across sort of GOP states, but also at the federal level. This would be the targeting of protesters with extremism or even sort of domestic terrorism charges or RICO charges in some cases.
Right.
Anti-riot charges if three or more people sort of block a road, right? And, you know, many people who are part of movement politics say there's an actual war on protest, a legal war protest. So it's not just happening with the sort of this is an inconvenience. And I think that that's not actually a partisan position right now. There seems to be a push both by, you know, Republican legislatures, but also in Democratic cities to push back against protest and dissent. And it's at this moment that everyone says is sort of this tipping point for democracy. I think we should be very concerned that protest is in the crosshairs.
You know, Elizabeth, this aversion to dissent is happening in other ways, too. You cover the entertainment industry, and it seems like some Hollywood bigwigs see protesting as an inconvenience for business or at the far end of the spectrum, you know, deeply disagreeable and wrong. Looking towards culture, you know, our musicians, our artists, our culture makers, this is a moment where, Elizabeth, you've wondered why there aren't as many of these people speaking out. And in part, it's because there's a risk to doing so. Does this feel new to you?
Yes and no. You go back to Jane Fonda during the Vietnam War.
She
was called a nag. People ridiculed her, really. A lot of people in power ridiculed her, and including the press. I mean, there's a Life magazine that literally called her, the headline was nag, nag, nag. But young people adored her because she had a huge platform. She was a star, and she shared their views, and she spoke their views. So she did pay, but it didn't stop her. But now, in the case of Susan Sarandon, she was dropped by her agent, UTA, and she's a lifelong activist. She gave a speech in November, and at one point she said, Jewish people are getting a taste of what it's like.
She said, essentially, Jewish people are getting a taste of what it feels like to be a Muslim in this country, so often subjected to violence.
UTA dropped her. And I followed her around recently, and I talked to her about it.
Both my agents that I'd been with for 10 years, who I was felt close to, are Jewish, and I was very happy to give them 10% of my earnings for 10 years, and I wasn't anti-Semitic then. So when I was told that by being in a march, it was too uncomfortable for them to advocate for me any further, it was quite shocking to me.
At another point, she said to me, I think they were trying to make an example of me. Right? Let's send the message out, celebrities who are thinking about joining protests. There will be consequences. There could be consequences. You may lose work if you do this.
Yeah. I wonder if that chilling effect extends to everyday people, not in Hollywood, you know?
What's happening is this pushback against dissent, right, is getting paired with this sort of pushback against talking about Palestine. And those two things are coming together to create a really dangerous moment for speech. And that speech on college campuses and that speech from Joe Schmo or anyone. And I think that what we're seeing is the state making it harder to protest by limiting the ability of bail funds to operate, by making protest in some places functionally impossible. And that really does take away the voices of people who feel like they have no other voice than to go to the streets.
Elizabeth, Sandhya, I have learned so much here. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brittany.
And as a thank you, I'd like to teach you both something by playing a game with you all. Can you stick around for a tiny bit longer?
Sure.
Yes, I think so.
Wonderful. All right. We'll be right back with a little game I like to call, But Did You Know? Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
The following message comes from NPR sponsor Sattva. Founder and CEO Ron Rudson is on a mission to bring quality sleep to more people.
Health and wellness are so tied to quality sleep. And I'm trying to tell everyone, look, you have to treat sleep like an activity, because I believe sleep is the most important thing in your life.
To learn more, go to SAATVA.com/NPR.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
All right, all right. It's time for a little game I like to call, But Did You Know? Here's how it works. I'm going to share a story that's been making headlines this week. And as I give you some background on the story, I'll also ask you trivia related to it. But don't worry, it's all multiple choice. And the first one to blurt out the right answer gets a point. So the person with the most points wins, of course, and their prize is bragging rights. Are y'all ready?
Yes.
All right, let's get into it. The music festival sensation Coachella is in full swing for its 23rd festival. The headliners this year are Tyler, the Creator, Doja Cat, and Lana Del Rey. Which makes this the first year that two women are at the top of the bill at the United States' biggest music festival. Since it began 23 years ago, what year did a woman first headline the festival? Was it A, 2008, B, 2012, or C, 2017?
Elizabeth, I feel like you should know this.
And I don't. I'm guessing A.
A was the...
2008.
Okay, I think it's later. I think it's, what's the middle one?
2012.
Yeah, let's do that.
You actually are both wrong. Even later.
It's
2017. It's 2017. Okay. Bonus point. Can either of you guess who it was?
Beyoncé.
Close. I don't know why I said close, but it's not Beyoncé. Elizabeth, what about you?
I really don't know.
It's all right. We're here to learn.
No judgment.
It was Lady Gaga who headlined the festival alongside Kendrick Lamar and Radiohead. And fun fact, reason why I said close, actually, Lady Gaga actually replaced Beyonce at the top of the bill because Beyonce had to delay her Beachella performance to the following year because she was pregnant with her twins, Rumi and Sir.
So that's what I meant to say, was that Beyonce was...
What you meant to say was that it was... I was just... You were yeah. too deep in the lore and...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, my Coachella, you know, trivia is it.
A little. And as I was thinking, surely Coachella would have been inspired by the Lilith Fair, all women, but no, apparently not.
Trust me, when I found out it was 2017, I was like, huh? No one before then?
I should have guessed that. I should have just been like, definitely the last latest. One you possibly expect, because that is the crap that would be real.
All right. Well, so far, you're both tied at zero, but you got Woo-hoo! Another question, another opportunity. Okay. In a lot of ways, it's not surprising that two women are at the top of this year's Coachella ticket. And let's get into why. Last year was a big year for music concert ticket sales with a record-breaking $9.17 billion. I repeat, $9.17 billion last year in concert ticket sales. What percentage of summer ticket sales went to women? Was it A, 48%, B, 57%, or C, 68%?
C.
C.
Unfortunately, you're both wrong again. The answer is B, 57%.
I probably even reported on this and have since forgotten.
I just want to point out that I feel like Elizabeth has an advantage in this particular area.
And look how well she's doing with her edge.
All right. So to recap the score, you are both currently tied at zero.
Zero.
Okay.
Zero.
So whoever gets this one, though, is going to be the winner. Okay. So without further ado, for our final question, this week, the pop girl dominance looks like it will march on. Taylor Swift just released a new album, which I'm sorry, has a terrible name, The Tortured Poets Department.
Terrible.
I'm so embarrassed by this name. Tortured Poets Department, like maybe more like Tortured Marketing Department. I don't know.
Tortured Billionaires Department.
Tortured Billionaires Department?
That's Elon Musk's first album.
Elon Musk's first. Oh gosh, please don't speak it into being. I do not need to hear any of his musical thoughts. Okay, based on past trends, Taylor Swift is poised to outsell everyone, of course. Of the past 15 years, how many times has Taylor Swift had the highest selling album of the year? Is it A, 5 times, B, 7 times, or C, 9 times?
Guessing B.
I would also guess B.
Well, the answer is B, 7. You both got it right. Yes, Taylor Swift has had the highest selling album of the year 7 times in the past 15 years. Plus, she's had the top selling album 3 out of the past 4 years.
The only new album I want is one from Tracy Chapman.
Well, oh my gosh. Elizabeth, you answered the third question correctly the fastest. So you win the point. You have won this game. You can still keep your culture desk pride.
Thank God.
All right. Well, that's it for But Did You Know for this week.
We didn't.
We didn't. Oh my gosh. Congratulations. And Elizabeth and Sandhya, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having
Thanks,
me.
Brittany.
That was NPR's Elizabeth Blair and Sandhya Dirks. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're looking back on OJ Simpson.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
A quick heads up, this segment contains descriptions of violence. My next big question is, how did the O.J. Simpson murder case change American media as we know it? O.J. Simpson passed away last week at the age of 76. O.J. was a complicated man, to say the very least, and over the last three decades of his life, his public persona and what he represented to people shifted dramatically. I was just a kid when he went from famous to infamous. After his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend were found murdered, O.J. went from a beloved football star to a fugitive on the run.
Reuters is reporting that the police tracked O.J. Simpson through his cellular phone, and that's how they picked up this car.
And then O.J. became the person at the center of the 1995 trial that gripped the nation, then tore it down the middle. And while he changed in the eyes of some people from an affable athlete to suspected murderer, he also changed the culture around him. And he definitely changed the media in ways we're still grappling with now. Today, I have two guests who can lay all that out for us. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco, who was working as a reporter in LA during OJ's infamous police car chase and subsequent murder trial. And NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, who saw how OJ shifted television as we know it. Eric, Mondalit, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, let's get into it. We are talking about a bold-faced name today, O.J. Simpson. He passed away last week, and he was a very complicated figure. How big of a deal was O.J. in his prime?
I've noticed that particularly with younger generations, they don't understand how beloved and how famous he was before the murder trial. He was a Heisman Trophy winner. He was in five Pro Bowls. And then he went from that to becoming a sports commentator and then also appearing in these Hollywood movies.
He was known for his TV commercials where he'd be running through the airport. Go, O.J., for Hertz Rent-A-Car.
I used to run through airports. Now I fly through them. With new Hertz number one express service.
And he was in Naked Gun movies, and he took a lot of pratfalls, kind of slapstick. He seemed in on the joke, you know? So it was really shocking when this news of the double murder of his ex-wife and her friend happened. This double murder just didn't square with his affable image at the time.
I tried to explain it to a younger person. You know, imagine if Tom Brady, at the height of his Super Bowl success, then went to star in Fast and Furious movies and then was accused of murdering Giselle.
That is definitely a way to put it. But staying on the topic of OJ's mass appeal before the trial, in the five-part documentary series from a few years ago, O.J. Made in America, one thing they talked about was how he essentially transcended race as this, you know, big celebrity football player. What did you think of that, Eric?
In a weird way, I don't think he really transcended race. But I think what you learn from O.J. Made in America is that he tried really hard. Like I saw somebody say, you know, he kind of escaped race like he ran away from a tackle. He did not want to be identified as being black. And one of his classic quotes was, "I'm not black. I'm O.J.
I'm O.J., yeah.
When we talk about respectability politics, we talk about this idea that if you just are clean cut enough, if you are wealthy enough, if you are well-liked enough, if you excel enough at sports or entertainment as a black person, then you earn your way out of oppression. And white people see you as worthy of being equal with them. Just like Bill Cosby, he was at one point considered this apex of respectability politics. White America loved him. They almost viewed him as like a safe black person. I mean, at a time when Olympians were given the Black Power salute in the Olympics, right. And people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Muhammad Ali were risking their careers to speak for black people. He was doing the opposite.
We're here to talk about how O.J. Simpson changed media. And the Bronco Chase was, I mean, it was a real watershed moment. Mondaleet, you were reporting on the scene. You were there. Can you describe what it was like?
You just had to follow the helicopters and find where O.J. was. And all these people were watching on TV. They ran out to the freeway.
People have pulled over, many of them carrying signs reading things like, "Save the juice, go O.J." People are literally cheering him on.
People didn't know what had happened, really.
Right.
It was like this circus-like atmosphere.
Local TV in Los Angeles would follow car chases. You just didn't have a car chase that was involving someone that the rest of the country would care about. I was in a newsroom in New Jersey, and it was on TV in the newsroom. We were all watching it, transfixed.
Yes, it was a huge moment. It was the car chase that maybe every other car chase would be measured against, like really demonstrating the power of all of us watching a car chase live. Anyway, there's a lot of our current understanding of modern media that springs from this whole situation, especially from this trial, which many a major news outlet has referred to as the trial of the century. Mondaleet, what was it like?
Well, it was a huge media circus, and everybody in that courtroom became celebrities too. They were like household names. They were satirized on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, OJ, I love your house.
Oh, thank you very much, juror number six.
They were his attorneys. Robert Kardashian was one of them, the father to the Kardashian family. And there was Simpson's flashy attorney, Johnny Cochran, and he brought a whole level of theatrics to the trial. He asked Simpson to try on the pair of gloves, like the ones that were found at the crime scene, and he tossed out all these gems when he was doing his arguments.
It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
You know, celebrity trials are not new, but they were not broadcast in real time on television like that.
Yeah.
There were other live news events like the Oscars or the Watergate hearings in the 70s, way before this. But, you know, O.J. Simpson's criminal trial was this high drama with huge ratings. And it wasn't just news, it was entertainment.
Yeah, it was a fateful decision by Lance Ito, the judge, to televise the trial. And once that happened, you had the situation where the TV networks eventually moved aside their daytime soap operas and just broadcast the trial.
I remember my mom was watching it every day.
Court TV saw its profile rise by covering it. And the legal experts who appeared in the coverage became stars themselves. So Dan Abrams, who's still ABC News' chief legal correspondent, Harvey Levin, he's the architect of the TMZ empire. And I would argue that the event that created the audience for shows like TMZ that dig aggressively into the private lives of celebrities was the O.J. Simpson trial. You have all these things coming together, and then they all kind of explode. Everything from the Kardashians to TMZ to some of the cable news anchors that we're used to seeing on TV today.
This trial became must-watch TV for the entire nation. And the Washington Post claimed that it supercharged the emerging genre of true crime. Americans changed the channel from soap operas to court TV. And this trial was broadcast for over 8 months, which makes sense because I remember it as such a significant part of my childhood, honestly. It also changed how media treated celebrities. But first, I want to get into how everyday people responded to OJ in the trial. Mondaleet, you were in the streets. You were talking to people. How did viewers think about or react to the trial as it developed?
When I talked to people in Los Angeles, like, for example, a white liberal family in Venice Beach on the west side of Los Angeles, they started with reactions like this one.
This trial was a big fraud, as far as I'm concerned. The guy is as guilty as sin.
That conversation spun out to this very racist thing of black and white, and like, it's us versus them.
Huh.
Then when I went to some of the black neighborhoods in LA to get reaction there, and the double murder had just happened 2 years after the LA riots, and those racial tensions were still simmering. You know, some people told me that Simpson, whether or not he was guilty of murdering his ex-wife, they were somewhat relieved by the verdict. I talked to Al Humphreys. I found him at a barbershop.
We said, wow, at least a black guy got away sometimes, because there's a lot of people, a lot of dead black folks that nobody ever went to jail for.
I also talked to people who said that O.J. Simpson didn't necessarily represent most black Americans.
O.J. means very little to me. I'll tell you this one way or another. Like Laura said, the man was not a black man. He was a white man in blackface.
And so during the trial, they said they weren't necessarily cheering on Simpson, but his lawyer, Johnny Cochran.
Look, this was a very tragic thing. Two people died, and they died very tragically, and nobody's applauding whether we think that this guy did it. Because I wasn't there, so I don't know who did it. But I do know that we have an adversary system. So this was a battle between attorneys, and our guy, our attorney, won. That's what we were happy about.
One thing that I noticed is that I think there were a lot of black people who wanted white people to know what it felt like when the cops who beat up Rodney King got acquitted.
Right. That was just a couple years before.
And so they were happy to see the verdict for OJ. They didn't necessarily care all that much about OJ as a black person. What they cared about was making white people feel what it was like to have the system betray you. And one of the other things that really bothered me personally was that people assume that because I'm black, that I thought O.J. Simpson was innocent and I was happy with the verdict. And both of those things were not true. I didn't think he was innocent. I was really bothered by the verdict. But I was really bothered by people's assumptions about what I thought about the case from looking at me. We don't know how to have nuanced conversations about race in America, especially about these really big topics. And we always want to talk about race when the worst things have happened. And so it was even hard for me to think about trying to write about OJ dying, because I still felt the trauma of living through it and trying to have reasonable conversations with people about race in an environment that was completely unreasonable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, OJ Simpson was such a specific character study of celebrity, really and truly. In many ways, he was one of one. But I wonder, how did O.J. Simpson shift our relationship, the public's relationship, to celebrity?
First of all, this whole culture of digging into celebrities' private lives and publishing investigations of their toxic behavior is something that I think got supercharged by the O.J. Simpson trial. Before that, my sense is that a lot of that was the realm of gossip columns, and you wouldn't have quote-unquote mainstream or legitimate news outlets really focused on it. After the O.J. Simpson trial, you could see the New York Times and CNN and mainstream news outlets spending time looking into this stuff. We also had Robert Blake, who was another well-known actor, get accused of murdering his wife. The stage was set for a different kind of journalism about celebrities. But the other thing to keep in mind is that at the end of all of this, he still had a level of fame that people responded to favorably, which is hard to imagine. When he got out of jail for the robbery charges, there's reporting that he wound up living in a mansion that was provided by a wealthy person who still supported him, let him use his Bentley, and he would walk into a bar in Las Vegas where he used to hang out, and people still wanted to take pictures with him and get autographs from him. People may be surprised to hear that other celebrities that are facing, you know, tons of criminal counts, you know, they may ask, why are people still supporting this person? O.J. Simpson and his life story can give you a sense of how people still wound up supporting folks who have been revealed to be incredibly toxic, terrible people.
Mondaleet, Eric, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to NPR culture correspondent Mondaleet Del Barco and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. You can find more of their work at npr.org. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Tiffany Vera Castro,
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.